Okay. Are there any questions before we start? No questions? Okay. There is likely to be a makeup class on Wednesday and maybe also on Friday. And the way it's going to work is the week after that, I won't be here. So I'm trying to decide how we're going to handle those classes. One of the ideas is that I'll have a makeup class on Wednesday. I understand that all of you can't show up for any random time I pick. So more likely than not, it'll be in the morning. I'll let you know the time. Those of you who are available, please show up. And then I will, if I have a makeup class on Wednesday, then what I'll do is I'll try to record it and then put it up somewhere on the web so that you can watch it. I can only guarantee that the audio and the slides will be available the way this is done. I sometimes also try to get my own little camcorder and record it and put it up on the Google video, but that may or may not work. So I'll try. So just to get an idea, if I were to have on a makeup class on Wednesday at 10 o'clock, how many people would actually be able to, I mean, this is not a commitment, how many people are likely to be able to show up? That's great, okay. So more likely than not, Wednesday at 10 o'clock, I will have a makeup class. And here is the other thing, so that the flow is not lost, what we'll do is the makeup class we'll be talking, so next week's two classes we'll basically be talking about correlation analysis and latent semantic indexing. That's in the main classes, okay? So the Tuesday's class would then be continued on to Thursday's class. The Wednesday and Friday really are supposed to be for the next week, okay? So even if you miss Wednesday's class, you will still be able to understand everything on the Thursday's class, okay? So you won't be affected at all by missing Wednesday's class, which, as I said, you won't be able to show up anyway. Some of you may not be able to.
The first class session of Wednesday is 9 to 10, 15.
Okay, that's, yeah, 10:30 would a significant number of the hands that were raised earlier go down if it was 10:30? Okay, then we will do it at 10:30. Okay. I will give you the room and everything. It won't be in this room. I'll send you guys information about the room, etc., before the class is held. Okay. That's one thing. The other thing is, there's nothing else that I have about. So I am pleasantly surprised that there were so many people writing on the blog. The stemming seems to be the thing that most people are interested in. But I'm actually happy that you guys are taking these things seriously. And I got Garrett. I read pretty much everything that you do write, because everything that is posted on the blog gets to me as a copy in my email, so I don't have to actually log into the blog. I think you can do that too by just subscribing to the RSS, but since I set up the blog, I just send myself a copy of the email. So I am reading what you guys are saying. Some of the times, you may have said something wrong, but I don't necessarily say anything because the next person would probably correct you anyway, so it doesn't make any difference. I asked Garrett and Raju also to monitor it, so if they have some things to add, that would be something that they would do. Again, we'll see how it goes. Once in a while, I have things that I want you to think about, and you can try to do that. So there was only one thing, as far as I remember, the one question, I think the stemming has been beaten to death. I don't want to talk about it anymore. But I think the one question that I don't think got answers that I wanted to hear at any rate is, what are the things that are not done in the way, let's see, where are we? Okay, that one. So what are the things that Trek can relevance judgment doesn't capture first of all, it doesn't capture, it assumes the judgments are binary, I understand that. And we also understand that it's actually a judgment of that particular user, not necessarily whoever of the user whose judgment they captured. But there's one other thing that we did talk about in the class. One of you said it, but I missed. But if you remember, we were talking about relevance of a document D with respect to some user U, some query Q, and the sequence of documents D1 to DI that they have seen until then. That's the way we actually look at relevance, right? To that extent, in fact, the judgments of relevance should be marginal relevance judgment, because you cannot just say this is relevant directly. You have to say it's relevant if it's the first document. If it's the 15th document and 14 of the documents or copies of this on the top of it, then you are sick and tired of it by then, okay? So really what you would need is marginal relevance judgments. And once again, the reason they don't do it is the same reason why they don't do every possible user in the world, because it's too costly to get so many judgments. And it's also, even for a single user, they have to consider every possible subset of documents that could have been returned beforehand. And say, if you have seen those documents for your query, would you consider this document to be relevant or not? Okay, so that's another thing that they don't capture in the judgments. So given that, there is not much you can do. You have to assume that relevance of a document is judged independently of all other documents. Okay, so it's just looked at by itself. Okay, there was an old story I remember where this guy wants to get his friend into trouble, and what he does is that there was going to be this little party where people get to, do talent show, and he tells his friend, the friend was going to do a particular song, okay, so he gets like 5 people coming before him to do the same song, so that by the time the friend comes up, everybody is ready to hit him with tomatoes or stones or whatever. The song might be okay, the friend might be a good singer, but really 5 times in the same party, you're not going to listen to it. Okay, so there is a question of marginal relevance. Okay, so that's the only thing that I have on the discussion on that one. One thing that, we are going to continue the discussion that we had last time on vector space ranking, but before I go off there, since although we are talking about traditional retrieval right now, but I can't stop you from thinking about web retrieval. And all your examples, you don't know what traditional information retrieval is. You never used one, okay? All your examples of information retrieval are web search, okay? So this is supposed to be a slide that I should tell you when the web search comes along, but I think you may as well talk about it now so that you can properly calibrate your insights as to why does this thing work, why does this thing not work. So for example, one of the things that people point out on large-scale studies on web queries is that if you were to try and categorize them into broad categories, then web queries tend to be can be put into 3 different categories. One is called the informational queries, where the user is looking for information on a topic, okay? The other is navigational queries, where the user is looking for the site which has some specific thing. It's like basically, I want United Airlines site. I want CSC 494 site, okay? And then the one is called the transactional queries, where the user not only wants to find the site, but after getting there, they want to do some transactions on that particular site, okay? So this is, again, there is, anytime when you're trying to take something like web queries and then categorize them, all categorizations are going to be somewhat iffy. There would be things that won't fall into this, and also there might be, things that don't exist. There are not that many queries of a particular type that might exist. Okay. However, this is a reasonable thing to keep in mind. The reason it is useful to keep in mind is that of these, what do you think are the queries that traditional information retrieval is really focusing on? informational query. What do you think are the queries that most of the normal people use web for? Navigational and transactional queries. Okay, there is no such thing called I am feeling lucky for informational queries. Right? So for example, if you want to know the ethics of pro-choice versus pro-life, right, and you want to learn about it by looking at all documents, there's no I'm feeling lucky, because there'll be one site which might take one position. That's not the one that you wanted to hear about. Okay? I am feeling lucky makes sense if there is a single answer for your query, which is a specific document. And so you have to keep this in mind, because although traditional information retrieval is what leads us to web search, most of the web search queries that you tend to get enamored with, if you start liking a certain search engine more than another search engine, because it gets you to the site you're looking for right away. That means you're looking for a site, not for information, more or less. Okay? So you have to keep that in mind in trying to make sense of whether or not certain techniques that we will discuss in traditional information retrieval, would they make as much sense for the web search. Okay? If in fact 95% of the time you're only doing navigational queries, then you know much of the informational queries, I mean the techniques that really make sense for informational queries, which is all the IR work, may not make huge difference. You know, you can still talk about, I mean, you can have two techniques which are very different in performance for informational queries, but they're basically indistinguishable as far as navigational queries are concerned. In fact, for the navigational queries, what matters are things like good indexing and maybe, you know, probably something like how important is the site. Okay? So I bring this up just so that most of the time, until we get back into web search, this informational queries is what we are talking about. That's why you need multiple answers to the query. Why do you need 10 answers if you're looking for a single site? It makes no sense. Okay? Last time we talked about the Boolean model, and then we started talking about the vector, the bag of words model. And the bag of words model can be used in multiple ways. So let's look at documents as bag of words. First of all, here's an example. So this is an example that we'll run through in the next couple of lectures, so you may want to pay attention. So here you have 10 documents, and then we have only 6 terms that we index these documents by. Okay, and these terms are database, SQL, index, those are T1, T2, T3, and regression, likelihood, linear, and that is T4, T5, T6. Okay, the idea is that if these keywords are more in your file, then it's more likely to be a database document, a document talking about databases. If there are keywords here which are more, then it's more likely to be a statistics document. Okay, it's talking about statistics, right? But obviously, there is in a purely database paper, there may be some mention of regression. And similarly, in a purely statistics paper, they might say database of points. And so there's always leakage both ways. Okay, that's the expectation. Okay, so, and I will assume that here is basically the representation of each of these documents in terms of these terms. D1 has 24 instances of T1, 21 of T2, and so on. Okay, so now clearly you can see, for example, that D1 is a pretty purely database-y document. The only word that it has, again, I told you this business about these are database and these are statistics documents, and I made sense to you because these are English words and you understand and you see that they are probably used in statistics. Your system has no clue, right? It's just, these could have been called T1, T2, T3, T3, T4, T5, T6. For all it cares. Those are just the names of the words. Okay? So the real question is that you could see that this, for example, is probably a database document, and by the time you come here, this is more of a statistics document. So keep that in mind. Okay? Now, so since this is a bag, The simplest thing you can do when you want to different, you know, the whole thing that we're trying to do is rank documents. And we will assume, one of the big assumptions we make all the time is we'll assume that a query is also a document. Query is also a document. Okay? So it's just a little document, but it's also a document. Okay? What that then means is, since you want to rank the documents in terms of the degree of similarity they have to the query, really what you need is to develop a method for talking about similarity between two documents. If you have that, then you know one of the documents is query is what would be the normal case. But in fact, using the similarity between documents is important too, because remember when we were talking about diversity, diverse results, what you want is the first document should be the one that somehow is most similar to the query. The second document is one which is still similar to the query but far from the first document. So it should be dissimilar from the first document. Okay? And similarity measures can be thought of in terms of distance measures. The inverse of distance is similarity. Okay? And that's where we were talking about last time too, that distance measures, if they have certain properties, it's a useful thing to have. Triangle loss inequality is a distance measure. Is a property of the distance measure. How many of you don't know what is a triangle law of inequality for distance measures? Just in case you don't, if you have A, B, C, okay, all we are saying is if you have a distance here DAC and this is DAB, this is DBC, and that's just a triangle right now. So you need a triangle law of inequality to be satisfied by the distance measure. If it has, then you would say it has that property. If not, it doesn't. Okay. And the triangle law of inequality only says that the sum of any two sides cannot be less than the third side. Okay. Okay. So the first measure, given that this is the bag of word semantics, right? Bag of words model. The first measure we'll look at is actually a sort of a bag-based measure, a set-based measure. Okay. So if you have two sets, right, if you just have two sets and you want to see how close is one set to the another set, then a reasonable distance measure is to take the cardinality of the intersection divided by the cardinality of the union. That's for sets. You generalize this to bags, it becomes what's called a Jaccard similarity metric. Okay. So all you need is, you know how to do intersection and union on sets. When you do intersection and union on bags, intersection becomes the min operator and union becomes the max operator. Okay, let's look at an example. So if A has 5 oranges, 8 apples, and B has 3 oranges and 12 apples. A is a bag, B is a bag. Okay, so now A intersection B is, since there are 5 oranges here and 3 oranges here, minimum of 5 and 3 is 3 oranges. And the minimum of 8 and 12 is 8. So the intersection bag contains 3 oranges and 8 apples. So its size is 3 plus 8, 11. And the union bag contains max of 5 and 3, which is 5, and max of 8 and 12, which is 12. So 5 plus 12, 17. That's all. Okay, so in this case, the Jaccard similarity would be 11 by 17. Okay, this is a reasonable similarity metric. In fact, any of these similarity metrics that we come up with, there is nothing particularly sacrosanct about any of them. It turns out that you could, vector similarity metric is used a lot, and we will try to give some reasoning as to why that makes sense. But really, ultimately, what we are trying to maximize is the relevance to the user, of which we have no clue. We don't know what the user is looking for. We're just hoping that if we do some similarity between the documents and the query, they would be happy, right? It's worth knowing various similarity metrics, because sometimes some of them have useful properties that you would actually wind up exploiting in writing the algorithm. Okay, so this is a Jaccard similarity metric. You can, with respect to this particular example, similarity between D1 and D2 would be 24 plus 10 plus 5 by that, and that would be 0.57. And you can look it up next, you know, at home and make sure that it makes sense. Okay, that's the Jacquard similarity matrix. Now we already talked about so the other way of looking at the bag of words is not as bags but as vectors. Okay, and that's the one we started talking about last class. Okay, now if you were to think of them as vectors, then essentially each dimension of the bag becomes a dimension of the space, and we are assuming that they are essentially n-dimensional space where n is the number of terms. Okay, documents are vectors in n-dimensional space. Okay, there are some interesting things in this actually. If you can think of documents as vectors in the space of terms, you can also do the opposite. You can think of terms as vectors in the space of documents. Okay, we won't do it today, but we'll do it next week. Okay, just as, you know, in any space essentially, so if you have you know, all the documents are shown as the axes are basically in this in the normal vector similarity model, the axes correspond to the terms, and each document becomes a coordinate in that space. So that I can look at this matrix in the opposite way. I can say essentially these are the dimensions and these are the points that I want to plot. And the reason that could be useful, it turns out, is, for example, if you want to know how close is one term to another term. If you want to compute, for example, synonyms between, you know, keywords, synonyms can be computed in terms of correlation. They seem to be occurring together all the time. So data and structure seem to go well together. So they are correlational synonyms. How do you figure this out? You know, it turns out that data and structure, the terms, are likely to be distributed very similarly in the over the document. So they are likely to be vectors very close to each other. Okay? But, you know, so there's that advantage, but let's think of documents as vectors in the space of terms, which is the more obvious one. And then I mentioned last time that there is a huge assumption being made here that terms are all independent, because that's the only way you can think of it as a reasonable space, but it's not actually reasonable to assume that they're independent, but we'll ignore that for now. Okay, we'll act as if they're all independent. And then, so the question is, I have two vectors, and so two documents would be two vectors. A query and a document would be one vector, query would be a vector, document would be a vector. So now I need distances between vectors. Okay, distances between vectors, if I have a two-dimensional space, I have a vector here, I have a vector here. I can consider the distances between them in multiple ways. One of them, of course, is the Euclidean distance between the point. That's a reasonable thing to do. Okay? So I could do the Euclidean distance between the two documents. Okay, because each document is a vector and you just take the Euclidean distance in the vectors. That's a distance measure. There's nothing particularly wrong with it. Okay, the way I stated it, actually it's slightly problematic because, in fact, remember that we had talked about some disaggregator, one of which says relevance should not overly depend on the size. Okay, so if I have a situation where I have a document D1, which is like this, and then I computed a new document, D1 dash, which is just concatenation of D1 10 times. So I just went into an editor, cut and pasted it 10 times. So D1 dash is now much bigger than D1, but basically has the exact same content repeated 10 times. Okay, so what would it look like? It would basically look like that. That would be the D1 dash document. And this is the D1 document. And I would like to see if in fact the distance between them is not dependent on the size. Okay, and one way you could do that is to say, well, if you don't care about the size, normalize the size. Just take the unit vector in the dimension in the direction of the document. Okay, so if I have two documents D1 and D2, then compute the unit vectors in the direction of D1, in the direction of D2, and then do your favorite measure. Okay, one measure, of course, is you can still go back to the Euclidean metric. So, for example, if I have two vectors here, and then I have the unit vector in this direction is that, unit vector in this direction is this. Now I'm trying to compute that distance. Okay, if you do that, this would be normalized Euclidean distance between documents. And it actually is hard to beat. There is no real obvious reason as to what it fails, I mean, which of these it fails on. Okay, I want you to think about this, because why is that not a reasonable distance? It is a reasonable distance. It does allow partial matches, because all you care about is, even if a particular document doesn't have one of the query terms, you know, that still doesn't mean anything. That means they are in two different planes, and you still can compute the distance between the two points. Okay, and this we can do independently anyway. And the size issue has been taken care of, because you are normalizing the document. Okay, now I assume that you know that you can always normalize a document by essentially dividing it by its magnitude. Okay, another way of computing the distance, which is also a distance measure, just as Euclidean distance has the distance measure properties, one other one is essentially the cosine theta distance. And all you are essentially saying in that case is, so you consider dot product between two vectors and then normalize that. Okay, dot product between two vectors, if I have two vectors, okay, dot product between those two vectors is what? You take the projection of one of the vectors onto the other vector and take that length, multiply it by the length of the first vector. That's all you want to do. So, you know, I take the projection of this onto this, I'll get a length, multiply that length by the total length. Okay? And of course, you can do it, you know, the other way of doing it is, of course, if you have two vectors, x1, y1, and x2, y2, then x1 times x1 plus y1 times, x1 times x2 plus y1 times y2 is the dot product. Okay? And then you can, if you do that, it is a distance, but it's not normalized. And then if you go ahead and divide it by the, and rather than do the dot product distance between the original two documents, if you take it between the unit vectors in those two directions, that would be normalized. Now it turns out that if you do that, that actually is also equal to cosine of theta. Why? Because if I have u here, if I have v here, and if this is theta, then the projection of v onto u would have the size of v times cos theta. And you multiply it by u, the size of u. Okay, that would be, so normally when you do dot product, what you're doing is u v cos theta. Okay, when you normalize, you're doing u v. So those get cancelled out, and what you really have is cosine theta. Okay, and cosine theta would just depend upon the angle. And if the angle is 0, cosine theta would be 1, and if it is 90 degrees, it would be 0. Okay? Yes? Synonyms, I mean, again, all a search engine can do is, this is again more about next week, but all we are saying is they are correlated. Okay? I mean, statistically in the world, you can only learn about correlation. You cannot learn about causation. Okay? So if two things seem to be occurring together, all you can say is they seem to be occurring together. It may well be that the first one actually causes the second one. Or maybe that the second one causes the first one. Or that a third one causes both of them together. You can't tell. You know, so all you know is correlation, and you use that. That is useful still, because people who are looking for this word might also want to look for this other word, because they seem to be going together all the time. Okay, but that's again really about terms. Okay. So this is about cosine theta metric. By the way, cosine theta also can be negative, right? What do we do with negative distances? wake up. If you ever get negative distances, you have to wake up. Okay? And how do we make sure that we don't get negative distances? There is no such thing as having negative number of instances of a term in a document. Do you understand? Every document would be a vector in the first quadrant. Do you understand? So the maximum angle would be 90, minimum angle would be 0. That's it. Again, this is sanity check. Okay, I mean, it's not exactly Nobel Prize winning information, but you have to ask yourself these kinds of questions because just to make sure that things are working out okay. Okay, so yes, cosine theta can be negative, but it will not be a problem for us because we only care about first quadrant. Okay, so that's basically all you need to know about cosine theta metric, and it is essentially a normalized distance metric, just like Euclidean distance. And in a way, it's cheaper to compute maybe because all you need is essentially pairwise multiply the individual coordinates and add them up. Okay, no square roots at any rate. Okay, so here's the question: if I were to compare cosine theta metric, normalized cosine theta metric, which I already told you is sort of very popular, with normalized Euclidean distance metric, okay, why should you expect cosine theta to be any better? It's not quite obvious, right? I can't prove that cosine theta metric is any better. But what I will do is I'll give you an example where it looks like, you know, cosine theta is doing things that is more to your taste than Euclidean distance is doing. Okay? So in this example, right, so essentially these guys, D1 to D5, actually, I mean, these are, you know, the D1 to D5 are very close to each other, in essence, because they're all database documents. D6 to D10 are close to each other, so because they're all statistics documents. And if I compute document similarity matrix, that means a 10 by 10 matrix where the ijth entry is the similarity between document DI and document DJ, computed using your favorite measure. Okay? Then, and also furthermore, I basically have to represent a 10 by 10 matrix. Okay, one good thing about all these normalized values, especially the cosine theta metric, is it's going to be, there is an upper bound and a lower bound, 0 and 1. Okay, 1 is very high similarity, 0 is very low similarity. Okay, so suppose I now compute this 10 by 10 matrix and I color code it such that if two documents are very similar, then I make that cell white, and if they're very dissimilar, I make it black. If it's in between, it's gray. Okay? Then this is how the cosine theta metric looks, and this is how Euclidean metric looks in terms of this particular set of documents. Okay? And both of them are able to see that a document is extremely similar to itself, right? Because they're white. Then essentially, they have to be similar to each other. A document has to be similar to itself. Okay? One can argue that this is a better situation than this because this also says that these guys are very close. These guys are very close. These guys are very close, and this entire quadrant is unconnected. Is not particularly similar. Okay. Whereas this guy, in essence, finds degrees of similarities between documents from different classes. Okay, in this example, since we already know that these are database documents, these are statistics documents, it looks like Euclidean measure is doing quite well. Okay, and this is sort of the best arguments that are available out there as to why, in fact, cosine theta metric is worth doing. Okay, otherwise, it's one of the reasonable distance metrics. Okay. Why would you say that? There could be a reason, but why would you say that?
Because in higher dimension, the distance is, I'm not sure, but like
it's okay. So here is one thing that actually all the pictures I'm drawing are in two dimensions because they only gave me a two-dimensional whiteboard, right? And if I can allow three dimensions, I can have three-dimensional vectors. But really, we are talking about million-dimensional vectors, where million is the number of terms. In this particular case, really, we are talking about six-dimensional vectors. Okay, and the point that, what's your name?
Lakshmi.
The point that Lakshmi makes is actually quite valid. In fact, one problem with Euclidean distance could be that, you know, you have two unit vectors in completely different dimensions. And so the distance can be, you know, it's not about the angle, you know, it's about the distances between the two edge points. And in general, your intuitions about vectors in low dimensions don't hold in high dimensions normally. And so in fact it's not, unless you have thought about high dimensions a lot, or you've been living in a high dimensional space without telling your parents, your intuitions and high dimensions, you know, low dimensions don't hold well. Okay, here is a couple of things I'll make you think about in the blog, but one of which, for example, is consider an n-dimensional sphere, okay, and then unit sphere of n dimensions, and then you think of it as an apple, okay, it's an n-dimensional apple, okay, and then you take your peeler and peel off epsilon thick apple peel, okay. Now normally your apples, once you peel, you know, with your peeler, there still is a huge amount of apple left, okay. So the question basically is, what is the ratio of the volume of the apple left to the original apple? In three dimensions, that's very high. In two dimensions, that's quite high. In three dimensions, that's still high. As n increases, it becomes zero. And it's not too hard to know, you know, too hard to figure this out. But we don't think about it because we don't see these things, you know. Basically, what you have is r minus epsilon power n by r power n, where n tends to infinity. Okay, so n-dimensional apples are all peel and no core. The moment you take the peel, they disappear. Okay, that's one thing. The other interesting thing about n-dimensional vectors is that if you pick any two random vectors, they are likely to be perpendicular to each other, which is actually pretty sad because that means they're going to be dissimilar. Okay, it's very hard to pick two random vectors in, you know, two dimensions that will be perpendicular. But as the number of dimensions increase, the probability that two randomly picked vectors are actually going to be, perpendicular is actually pretty high. Sometimes this works against you. In this case, actually, this actually kind of works against us because similarity metrics don't work so well in high dimensions. Okay. There is no hierarchy in dimensions. X, Y, Z dimensions, which is the more important dimension? There is none. All of them are equally good. Okay. The problem is, you know, there are three dimensions. And as you increase the number of dimensions, basically what happens is two vectors can become perpendicular to each other very easily, as long as one of the vectors doesn't have a projection in one of the dimensions that the other has, then they become perpendicular. So it's much higher chance that they become perpendicular. Okay? Yes?
But then when we consider two vectors, we are basically considering a plane in which that is formed by those two vectors. We are not considering n dimensions when we are finding this.
I agree.
So then.
The distance part, it's not going to be unbounded between the two edges. Okay? All I was saying was that the pictures, yes, so the. I guess I just used this to also talk about the problems with n-dimensions, okay? The point that she made, which is, will the Euclidean distance between unit vectors in high dimensions have crazy properties? And would it be, you know, what's the highest that they can be? Okay, they're not going to be unbounded. The distance between two unit vectors is still not going to be unbounded, okay? But the only thing this particular picture is telling you is that in this kind of examples, it looks like our intuitions as to how you would say these documents are similar to each other seem to be more in rhyme with what cosine is saying. This is not a proof, but you know, this is a reasonable explanation as a reasonable rationalization as to why people are using this. Yes.
If you have one of these methods, you can calculate another.
Yeah.
Easily. And why not to find different types of functions and to set of rules and find appropriate?
Yeah, they have done that. They have done that. And in fact, you know, in the beginning, there were, this is just one set of metrics, and you know, for like basically original traditional and original information retrieval would talk about lots and lots of different metrics. And even now, you know, you can take a random paper, they would suddenly use Jaccard similarity metric because it turns out that it has certain interesting properties that they can exploit. And nobody is really serious about any one of these distance metrics. So for example, another thing that happens is that after you get this distance metric that you already got right now, what would you use it for? You have a query and you compare this query to the documents, compute the similarity, and rank them in the order of reducing similarity. And you want top 10 documents and you're going to show it to the user. Now one computational issue is if you are strict about getting top 10 documents, then you really have to compare your query to every one of the documents. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you have a billion documents in your corpus, and you're strict about guaranteeing that when I give the top 10 documents, I mean they're top 10 in terms of similarity, you know, vector similarity, then the only way you have to do it is by looking at all billion documents. Okay? But we all know that nobody really cares about what you think about the similarity between the query and the documents. We are hoping that somehow this would be relevant to the user's relevance metric. Okay? So you're not particularly crazy about ensuring that you get exactly the top 10. So you can approximate. Okay? And in fact, most search engines, what they do is they do all sorts of things to cut down the number of comparisons you make on a billion document corpus from billion to more like a million. Okay? Now, when they do that, if you know that they do it, you can always defeat it. You can always defeat it in terms of getting the top 10 correctly ordered vector similarity metric document. But that's not what they are for. They are to actually make the users happy, and as long as the users are happy, you know, it's fine. And users never really cared about vector similarity anyway. Okay, again, I don't know how many of you understood this. Where am I? I'll go back, don't worry. There. How many of you know the parable of drunk searching for the keys? That's what we are doing in information retrieval. So basically, the story goes that you see a drunk in the middle of the night searching for his or her keys under a street light. And then so you see this guy or this girl and say, "So what happened? Oh, I lost my keys." "Oh, so you lost them here?" No, actually I lost them there, but there's no light there, so that's why I'm searching under the light. Okay? So you're not searching in the right place, you're searching under the light because there's light. Okay? That's essentially what we are doing in information retrieval. Okay? What we really want is this, but that's too hard, so we will do this. But there is no point in being particularly crazy or strict about doing this either, because you know that ultimately the marks come from this. Okay? Okay. Okay, that's that. And so answering queries, you take a query and then you compute. So if you have something like database index, let's say as the query, okay, remember that these are all terms like database, index, regression, etc. So that would just be the query now would be a vector of type 10100000. Okay, and so you just take the dot product between this vector and any of the documents. Okay, now here's an interesting thing. Strictly speaking, since this is a vector, this is a document, and since you are supposed to actually consider only the normalized length, You might say, well, first thing I should do is divide this by square root of 1 square plus 1 square, which is square root of 2, so I get 1 by root 2, 1 by root 2, as the two non-zero dimensions. But really, nobody cares what the, even those people who care about vector similarity distance only care that you ordered the documents in the right order, not that you gave them the exact number. So what that means is, as long as you normalize the documents, you don't need to normalize the query. You'll get the same order, right? So that's a cheap thing, you know, at least one little less work that you have to do. Okay, but in this particular case, I believe we normalize, and I don't quite remember, I think we didn't normalize this, but we normalized those, okay? And the TF distance, the distance that you compute this way, the vector distance would be that, cosine theta metric distance. Okay, for each of the documents with respect to this query. And so clearly D5, according to my database, D5 is the best result. Okay, I don't know whether you like it or not, because let's see what. So D5 is this, and I was looking for database index T1, T3. Okay, so D5 has 43 instances of database and 20 instances of index. And this guy has 24, but this is 9, and this guy has 32, but this is only 5. So it looks like it's a reasonable point to make that, in fact, this guy has maximum number of both database and index. Okay, so at least, you know, it seems to make sense as to what the actual distance metric does. Oh, actually, I had this here. I should have seen this. Okay, that's it for the normal vector similarity metric. Okay, the other thing, of course, is that we said different words should be allowed to have different weights. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay. In fact, we already have taken into account the fact that a word can appear multiple times. So we are considering these as vectors with 24, 21, 9 as the projection. Right? You could have, if you did not care about the number of times a particular word occurred, then you would have just thought of them as ones and zeros across the board. Okay, so that's why the normal vector similarity metric, we'll just call that TF distance. Okay, it just takes term frequency, raw term frequency. Okay, what we can then do is, the only problem, of course, is that, of course, we did do that, but the length is still normalized by the length of the document in each of the vectors. Okay, one thing we can do is to normalize TF also. First of all, you can say that the TF measure in each document for a term would be the term's frequency in that document divided by the maximum occurring term frequency in the document. So if this term occurs 10 times and there's another term which occurs 25 times and that is the maximally occurring term in this document, then the normalized term frequency for this would be 10 by 25. Okay, so you're doing two normalizations now. Now, first you're actually normalizing the term frequency itself, and then anyway, in the end, you will normalize the length. Okay, but this is something that seems to have a good advantage. So you would do the TF that way. The other part is the IDF, which is the most interesting aspect of vector similarity metric idea, where you say that you should consider words that appear in all documents to be useless, essentially. That's what you want to say. Okay, any word that appears in every document, it doesn't matter that you have a whole bunch of those, whole bunch of the instances of that word. Okay, and so you define this idea called inverse document frequency, and all that is, you know, it should be essentially inversely proportional to the number of documents this term appears in. Just appears in, not how many times it appears. The number of documents this term appears in. And if it's a common term, then it appears in many, many documents. So inverse of that will be smaller and smaller. Okay. One way you could do that, that would be reasonable enough, but one thing that you wind up doing actually is you define IDF this way. You take up the log of the total number of documents divided by the number of documents in which that term appears. if I just don't do the log, this is already correct, right? This is basically inversely proportional to the number of times the number of documents that seem to have this term. Okay, and then you take the log. You could do it in multiple ways. One theoretical reason you can make up is that you can say that this is essentially connected to the information content of that word. Okay, there's the information theoretic justification to do that in terms of logs. But another way is actually to say that it makes it smaller number. No, it's basically going to be, if n is a billion and this word appears in only one of the documents, then you have n by ni to be billion. So the TF-IDF then would be the TF measure is the frequency divided by the maximum frequency of any term in the document, and IDF is essentially the how many documents this term appears, inverse of that, log of that. Okay, one of which is a local measure, the other is a global measure. TF is very much dependent only on the current document. Right, and the IDF depends on the other documents. So this is important because if you start with a small corpus of five documents and you keep growing them by adding more and more documents, you never have to recompute the TF values, but you do have to recompute IDF values. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, if I only had documents from English in my corpus, okay, the IDF of all the articles would have been very low. In fact, it will be zero because every document will contain the. But then I throw in, you know, I diversify and get, you know, 50% more, I mean, like, you know, as many German documents into the mix. And I'm assuming they're not any, the, T-H-E is not a common word in German documents. All of a sudden, the IDF of the has increased, which is the common example that we were talking about earlier. So as the document corpus changes, the IDF changes. Okay. That's it. And so you basically, instead of computing just the TF-based vectors, you compute the vector now in terms of for each term, the term frequency multiplied by the IDF. That would be your new vector. Done it for every document. Okay. One other thing is for query, what do you do for term weight? I already said for query, you don't even need to bother about normalizing its length because essentially you're going to compare it to all the documents. Okay. The other thing, of course, is query is not really a document. Query is not really a document. And so because of which, you should probably consider it slightly differently from normal documents. Again, people have tried all sorts of tricks. And then most common is to just ignore all tricks and assume that the query, you just take it in terms of ones and zeros. Just ignore everything else. Just take it in terms of ones and zeros. So no TF normalization and no IDF normalization. Okay? But here is another approach where you are essentially saying the weight for the Q term in the ith term in the query would be 0.5 plus 0.5 times the TF divided, you know, multiplied by the IDF. And what this is doing is to make up for the fact that the query is too small in general in length. So you're adding an extra 0.5 up front. Okay. Now, is it supposed to work? I can argue again, you can just as is stemming supposed to improve or reduce precision? You guys had great arguments that you can do it either way. But similarly here too, you know, is it a good idea or not? You know, some tech track systems have used it and have shown good performance on the track test. Track, by the way, in case you already forgotten, is the text retrieval competition, which is the main competition for information retrieval. Okay. Now, another idea is to let the user give weights to the keywords to reflect their real preferences. Okay, here's the question. Without looking at your laptop, if you say, you know, if you say happy person to Google versus happy, happy, happy person to Google, do you get different results or the same results? What? You can go and check. Okay, and then you'll know whether or not they are considering queries as ones and zeros, otherwise they're considering as bags. Okay. Okay. And then, of course, the problem is you can let the users actually give weights to the keywords. In some sense, if I really am very much into happy, and the person is like incidental, so I should say happy, happy, happy person. And if the search engine somehow takes the repetition into account, I should get really happy things, some of which are persons. Okay? But the problem, of course, is the users may or may not know how to give weights to the keywords. Okay, remember, users have a big cloud in their head and they convert it into a couple of keywords. So they're just as clueless. Okay, so the idea then would be to actually use something called relevance feedback techniques that we'll get into in a couple of minutes, where, you know, even though the users give a query, when they look at the answers that you provided to them, when they are looking at some answers more than other answers, then you realize that maybe that's the kind of thing they are looking for. Okay, this is exactly what the used car salespeople and the sari salespeople were doing. You know, you go in and you say, I'm looking for this kind of a car, but then after they show you a couple of cars, you seem to be gravitating more towards a certain type of car then. So essentially, they'll ignore what you said. You say, oh, I'm a grad student or undergrad student, I'm looking for a cheap car. And then he shows this, you know, clunker of a BMW for like $50,000 or something, and you're going more and more towards it. He knows that you have rich parents, and you can easily be sold one of these clunkers. Okay? And so he or she will start showing those kinds of cars for the rest of the time, which makes sense, because all that matters is not happy parents, but the happy customer. Right, and if you get, you know, a car that you wanted, you're happy. That's what relevance feedback tries to do, and we'll talk about that in terms of the vector similarity metric in a minute. Okay, in terms of our example, so if you have these as the documents, if you do TF-IDF normalization, the raw documents without the actual TF-IDF, this is TF-IDF, TF times IDF for that term, this is TF times IDF for that term, and so on. Okay, and that's how those vectors look. Okay, in essence, what they're saying is, if you have a huge number of instances of a fairly common term, you don't get as many points as somebody who has a couple of instances of a very uncommon term, which makes a lot of sense. Okay, so anyway, those are the TF-IDF vectors corresponding to these documents. And then now what you do is you compute the query similarity to these documents, these vectors, using the same cosine theta metric. And those are the numbers that you get here. Okay? And so previously D5 was winning, but now suddenly D2 is winning. Okay, in our example. So D5, 43, we were looking still for data and index. D5 had 43 instances of data, 20 instances of index, and now D2 is winning. D2 has 32 instances of document, of database, and 5 instances of index, but it's winning. Okay, I'm not quite sure. Can you make sense of this? It basically, I'm not myself sure whether I can make sense of it for you right now. Both are increased. The only thing we can talk about is the proportion, but that doesn't make a difference. It's not, you know, there are certain things that you can easily see changing. For example, if there is a very common word and you have a large number of instances of it, its weight will go down when you multiply it by the IDF. Okay? But after you do this, the numbers you get, you take them as your similarities now. And this is pretty much the common usage in vector similarity metrics. Okay, so you compute TF-IDF vectors and then take the vector similarity. Okay? So here's the summary of the vector similarity model. And then basically there is this idea of considering normalized vectors, you take the cosine theta metric, and then you also do normalization of the term frequencies, and then multiply them by the inverse document frequencies, which is talking about how common that term is. Okay. There are all sorts of things that are wrong with vector similarity metric. Okay. But I won't even talk about it, because much of information retrieval, you could say, is all wrong, because we are trying to guess what people are looking for. Okay. Many, many things can be improved. For example, if I'm looking for a certain, you know, here are a couple of things. So, for example, assumes independence of index terms. That's a huge, big problem. Does not handle synonymy and polysemy. So if you are looking for a word and there is this other word which is very similar that the document contains but not the word you looked for, then it won't bring that document out. Okay? And that's something, that's a problem. And we will look at this and this together next week when we look at latent semantic index. Sort of tries to answer both of those. Okay. But on the other hand, if people are happy with the way vector similarity metric is performing right now, they won't be too happy with the fact that you came up with latent semantic indexing, because that's actually going to be computationally costly. Okay. And then the other one is that the query weighting may not reflect users' relevance criteria. They just said happy person, but they really meant happy is more important than the person. Okay. So what we will do is first look at how to deal with this, which is how to improve the, how to make the query weighting be more reasonable. And I'm going to, okay, that's basically what we will do, which is the idea is relevance feedback, where you are going to change the existing query. That's what I just told you, you know, the used car scenario. You change the existing query based on what the user said is actually relevant. So the general idea is you show the top 10 documents, okay, and then the users may click on some of them or may actually come out directly and say these are relevant, these are not relevant. And then when you show the next 10 documents, now you take this feedback into account. Whenever I say you, information retrieval engine. Okay, that looks like a reasonable thing. And the question, of course, the approaches differ in terms of users actually selecting the relevant documents. Okay, or you yourself, deluding yourself, and say, okay, here's the query. I do vector similarity, I rank my documents, the top 10 must be what the user really wanted, so let's assume that user really wanted them, take that as the relevance feedback and use it. This is pseudo feedback. What's interesting is pseudo feedback works fine too. Okay, but obviously direct relevance feedback works better if users can be bothered to tell you what they like, what they don't like. Now even in that, so even when users give relevance feedback, there are two ways they can do it. One is actually say, this document is relevant, this is not relevant. Okay? The other they can say is, is not make that judgment directly, but implicitly show that they're more interested in these documents by staring more at a particular document, by clicking on the document and clicking back again. Okay, so these are all indirect inputs. Now, obviously, you know, indirect inputs are what you expect from the user when, you know, even in the used car scenario. You start longingly looking at certain car, that means you're much more interested in that. Okay, so we will look at, we'll assume that, you know, basically the technique that we will that we describe, a simple relevance feedback technique, which is actually quite easy to understand, and I can describe this before we leave today, is going to work in all those cases, but its effectiveness depends on whether it was a direct relevance feedback or whether it was a pseudo relevance feedback. Now one question before we go up, one question you want to ask yourself is, do users know what they really want? Even if they actually stare at certain results more, does that necessarily mean that that's what they're looking for? And I'll refer you to some study which basically did the following cute thing, where they allowed a bunch of people to basically tell, you know, they won't be told what are, they're being told that Google is sending these results, Okay, and here is the query that Google is sending the results. Decide which ones are good for you, and they'll start clicking on them, and then you look at whether they click more in the top ones or bottom ones. Okay, and then unbeknownst to them, they also, you know, in some cases, they also just flip the top two results of the Google, and then presented it to the user saying Google said so. Okay, and what was interesting is that most of the time they picked whatever is the first result, not what they were looking for necessarily, but whatever is the first result. What that means is we have no clue what we are looking for, but let Google tell us what we are looking for. Okay, so now in such scenarios, obviously pseudo feedback is just as good because Google can ignore you guys and then just take its top 10 results and use that as its own relevant feedback and improve its search. But this is real study. This involves real people, and it tells us how intimidated we can be about, you know, somebody else's judgment of relevance. Okay, but you know, keep that in mind. But you know, that besides, we'll assume that somehow people will know how to tell us which documents they like, which they don't like. Now, here is the idea, and for relevance feedback, it's one of the cheapest ideas that you can learn in this class. Yes, sir.
A question. I mean, how relevant can document really be if the user clicks on it and clicks back? I mean, this is a decision he decides. It isn't too relevant because
I agree.
If it was relevant, he would click to this.
I agree. The point is, indifference is worse. I mean, which is worse? Indifference or at least clicking one? Okay. This becomes even bigger issue in ads. Right? If basically the search engines make money when you click on the ad, not when you buy the stuff from the ad. Okay? So it becomes a much more interesting issue as to what should be optimized and what should you know, count. You know, search engines ensure that you are likely to click on the ad, not that you are likely to buy the product that the advertiser is selling. The advertisers are hoping that you will buy their product. Otherwise, why should they give the money to Google? But you know, this problem occurs both in all places. But essentially, the idea is somehow click does mean that you're interested in it. That's the idea.
So then the only way to know that the user is not having a document is not relevant is that the user doesn't click on it.
Yeah. So in fact, that's why we will assume that in the beginning, the way we develop relevance feedback approach is we'll assume that the users will give us categorical assurance that these are relevant, these are not relevant. Okay, and they know what they're talking about. And then, of course, you know, when they don't, then we obviously the technique won't be as effective. Okay, now let's start from the simplest scenario where suppose the user gave a query, Q, and then you showed the documents. In fact, you showed them all the documents in the corpus. All the documents in the corpus. And the user had nothing else to do anyway. So they decided to go through all the documents and said, here are the documents are definitely relevant to my query. Again, assume binary relevance model. And here are the documents are definitely irrelevant to my query. So they come, you know, they look, they went through, they not only were nice enough to give you a query, but they also went through the entire corpus and separated it out into relevant part, irrelevant part. Now I ask you, if you have a chance to reformulate the user's query based on what they did rather than what they said, what would be the best vector query? Do you understand what I'm saying? So there was a query. So here is, you know, a bunch of documents in the space. A bunch of documents in the space. And the user said, these X's I hate, and you know, these zeros I like. What would be the best query? The best query, yes, sir.
Return the ones that you like.
No. This is a made-up story, obviously. So the idea is they did it once, and then we play this game next time around, where when they give this query, we'll only compute this idealized query and show just the top 10 results. Okay. Again, this is a made-up scenario. Nobody will do this. This will lead us to what we'll actually do. So this scenario essentially says, if you know these are relevant, these are irrelevant, you know, what you do is the centroid of the relevant documents and the centroid of the irrelevant document. The query vector should be close to the centroid of the relevant documents, far enough from the centroid of the irrelevant document. That's all. Okay? So I compute the query vector this way. This is my new query vector. So there was actually a queue that the user gave. I ignored it and said, this is the real query. And if you run this query using vector similarity metric, you are likely to get these to be the, the relevant ones, these to be the relevant ones. Now, having said that, if you understand that, then all we care about is the fact that, A, the user doesn't look at the entire document set. They look at just the top 10 that you showed. Okay, in those top k, they said these are relevant, these are irrelevant. So you could basically do, the new query to be just in terms of those documents. But since you know that the top k are probably not representative of the entire document corpus, you probably don't want to change your query too drastically. Do you understand? Okay, previously, there was nothing more that the user can say. Once they told us in the entire corpus what's relevant, what's irrelevant, it doesn't matter what the query was. This is the right query. But if they only saw the top 10, a top K, and then said which of them are relevant, which of them are irrelevant, then you still do essentially this piece, forget the beta and gamma for a minute, but this piece essentially the same as this piece. Okay, all I'm doing is I'm basically doing alpha times Q0 plus this, so that there is still, you change the existing query a little bit in the direction of this new query. And that would be my effective query. Okay, now the beta basically, and beta and gamma are, again constants that you pick, that you the designer picks. And it'll be fun, and you will talk about it in the blog as to, what are their effect on the precision and recall. Relevance feedback. And what is relevance feedback supposed to improve? It's supposed to improve, if it's ideally, in the ideal case, they should improve both precision and recall. Okay? And then what we'll do is you would talk about the effect of setting beta and gamma on precision and recall. You could think about it now, too. Okay. So normally you could set this is 1, this is 0.75, that's 0.25, and that's a reasonable setup. But there are many different variations also possible. Okay. So that's your relevant feedback idea. So here is an example. So suppose I have two relevant documents and one non-relevant document, and this was my original query. Then it's just a bunch of vector additions and centroid computations. Okay, and if this is alpha equal to 1, beta equal to 0.75, gamma equal to 0.25, then the new query would be this. Now, so you would apply this new query to bring out the next top k results. Okay? What is the closest you see to this technique being done in the current day search engine? First of all, you have to understand that there is no such thing as top 10,000 results. Every search engine can show you the first 10 results, and when you go to the next page, it can at that point of time dynamically compute a new next 10 results. You don't know, until they came into existence, you don't know what they actually had. So first of all, it's possible that based on the click pattern that you had on the first page, you could be changing it in the second page results. You can re-rank the second page results. Okay, and I can prove it and disprove it. You can ask Brin or Page, and they probably won't know anyway. But that's possible. But a more interesting issue is it's actually something very similar to this, which is changing the query into something different, is done in every search engine right now. Where is it done? I mean, you can see. No, that's all about profile, but if you try to visualize the way the search engines are presented to you, okay, after the search engine is presented, let's just try to do this. You have a minute still, don't worry. No. This is obviously the most important query. You should all try this. You should pay attention. That's the question. Okay, let's see. This one doesn't have it. Let's try to google.com. Okay. I argue, apart from the beauty of the top result, I argue that there is something important in this result which does something very similar to relevance feedback. What is it? What? No. Yes. How do they do similar pages? All you need, when you click on similar pages, they don't have to do clustering. In fact, the simplest way to do similar pages is to take that document as the query. One of the nicest things, you know, they say that one of the great things about Lisp is that the program, the program can write itself because the data and the program are in the same syntax. They're all lists. One of the great things about vector similarity is the query and the data are in the same exact syntax. They're all documents. I mean, they're all vectors. So when I click similar pages, all I need to do is I need to take this document, write this as a vector back to my vector similarity metric. You understand? So that is definitely what is being done. That's one thing that's clear-cut case of relevance feedback. Yes, sir? Yes, so they had tried all those things and they found that users have no time. Right? You know, again, there are great ideas that you can do in terms of learning. Again, remember what I said about Gmail. The great thing about Gmail is not that it's a mail accounting system or that, in fact, is one more way Google can make money off of you from advertisements. But really, you are forced to be logged on. And so there is a way they can capture your profile, at least indirectly. Nobody gives any direct feedback. People want results without opening their mouth, right? And yes, in the old days, search engines would also say things like, has this been good for you? Or, you know, if you are in one of these, I think more recently when I called some bank telephone operator, at the end of which this lady very modestly asked, have we been of excellent service to you? And, you know, there is no answer unless you really want to slap them on the face. But the point is, they did ask these kinds of questions, but nobody really bothered giving any answer. And so they removed it. And there were some, in fact, I think, Excite, which is another search engine, in the beginning had direct relevance feedback in it. But they removed it because nobody was using it. That's one idea. That's one point too. You know, I think profiles basically do help a lot because it also tells the search engine about your long-term behavior. Okay. So we basically are done with relevance feedback metric 2, and what we'll do when we come back next class is essentially talk about how to handle this other problem, these two other problems. These are by no means the only problems, but these are the ones I know the solutions to, so I listed them conveniently. And so we dealt with the query weighting because relevance feedback allows query weighting to be dynamically computed. And then independence of index terms and synonymy and polysemy we'll talk about next class. And the basic idea would be thinking of terms as vectors in the document space. Okay?